Questo podcast è stato realizzato nell'ambito del progetto PRIN 2020 React.
So I wanted to start with a metaphor that has been used by the European Coalition for Corporate Justice, which is an activist group, as the name tells, says, fighting for corporate justice. So the coalition defines the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive as a superhero for responsible business conduct, ready to set powerful standards that would require big European and non-European companies to address the climate and social impacts of their global business activities. And I use this metaphor because I think it's quite effective in describing a complex piece of legislation which is and will be, I'm sure, the product of compromise. So I want to stress from the outset that it's not going to be a perfect legislative instrument, but I want to start with a positive note and say that finally we have, we will have shortly, it's only a matter now of months, we will have an EU-wide sustainability due diligence regime. And that is because, as I will go on to show, this is only one piece of the puzzle. There are already other legislative instruments, either directives or regulations, in sectoral areas of EU law, which I will touch upon. I won't examine for reasons of time, but my point being that the outcome is to be welcomed, because what we will have is a coherent regulatory area in relation to corporate activity. So with that in mind, I'm going to give an overview of what I'm going to be looking at. So I'm going to start off, first of all, by providing the context, because I think it's important to understand the significance of this proposed directive. I think it's important to understand what the problems are and what the directive is trying to tackle. I will then examine the legal, the regulatory framework, and that's because it's what we have is an international framework which is made up of hard law measures, so to speak, but largely, heavily soft law measures, or, as we shall see, corporate social responsibility mechanisms, which some of you might know are based on an entirely voluntary basis rather than introducing an obligation for corporations. And I'll briefly explain there what the limitations are. And then I will conclude, but not least, with an overview of the main aspects of this very important piece of legislation. And in doing so, we'll start by showing how this is not new as such. The idea of having some kind of legally binding regulation is not new. We do have laws at national level in an increasing number of EU countries. But as I said, the main problem there is obviously the so-called regulatory chilling effect. You know, if you have legislation or regulation in one country, then automatically corporations will move somewhere else, right? And this is not only in relation to this area. We have ample examples of that happening, for example, in relation to taxation, right? We've seen that every time that a country, think about Ireland, tries to, increase the minute level of corporate tax to Google, you know, Google does threaten to move its European headquarters elsewhere. And so that is why You know, this already illustrates how important it is, you know, to have an EU piece of legislation, considering also how important the EU is from a trade point of view. Okay, so as I said, I wanted to start. Let's see if I can move the.
Try with the arrows.
I did try with the arrows as well. Okay. Just more force. Okay, so first of all, I wanted to start, as I said, by describing global supply chains, how they operate, particularly in the garment sector. So nowadays, most goods and commodities are made by a global workforce, which is scattered across a plurality of sites, comprising different countries, different workplaces, and different employers. And multinational retail companies manage and control vast amounts of global production across this very complex transnational web. And, you know, I included, if you look at the very first picture on the top, you can see literally that it is a web, right? It really is very complex. And so these retail giants that are at the apex of these multinational networks source products through commercial contracts across a multiplicity of suppliers, each of which is a legal entity in its own right, employing its own workers. And so this complex system allows products to be made at low cost, as we know, and quickly. However, and this is the concern today, it also staves off any legal responsibility of transnational corporations for abusive labour practices that are associated with their production. And I stress that even in circumstances, for example, where the subsidiaries could be held liable under tort law, for example. So far, courts have been very reluctant to find transnational corporations accountable for violations of labour rights by their suppliers. And therefore, while they dominate the global market and create and impose market rules, they bear very little responsibility for the negative impact. And, you know, now we have many reports about abusive conditions in many Asian garment factories, which produce clothes or shoes of very well-known brands. In the UK, Marks and Spencer's, but I think we all know H&M, The Gap, Nike, Adidas, just to name the most well-known. And they continue to focus, these reports continue to focus attention on the working conditions in global supply chains. Recently, we read in the news about the strike of female workers in Bangladesh, for example. And in fact, we can say right at the outset that there's a gendered impact as well, because in many factories, it is largely women who produce clothes. And when we think about tragedies like Rana Plaza in Bangladesh, where more than 1,000 people died, unfortunately, in those numbers, we also have to take into account how many children died, because a lot of women regularly, I mean, they still do take their children with them to the factories. And so they have been raising awareness, these reports, for quite a long period of time as to the need, also almost a moral obligation on our part as consumers of these products that are made in these countries, that something has to be done to ensure workers' safety and more generally social justice in relation to many aspects, which I will mention in a moment. But again, turning back to the legal dimension, the main concern here is ensuring that workers have proper, adequate access to legal and judicial remedies against transnational corporations. And this fragmentation of the way products are made nowadays also reflects, or better said, is reflected in, as I said, the regulatory framework. Precisely because, as I said, what we have, okay, so these two pictures, what they show is that at each level of production, you have separate employers and separate workers. So the distance between multinationals, so global buyers in the context of the garment sector, and the workers who actually make parts of the product, I mean, I'm looking at the garment sector, but we know, you know, I'm using a computer which we know has different parts made in different parts of the world. So it is a generalized problem, right? So the distance between workers and multinational companies increases. And that means, even from a legal point of view, going back to tort law cases, which are the ones where there's so far a better chance of succeeding for compensation, the distance is relevant, right? Because courts so far have largely said the remoteness is so significant that you cannot establish a causal link between the violations that workers are have been a victim of and the damage allegedly made caused by multinational corporations. And I will also be touching on the exacerbation of these problems by COVID-19. Now, so COVID-19, the pandemic has actually worsened the conditions of workers, and I will touch upon that in a moment. Okay, so moving on then to the international regulatory framework. This again maps the current system that we have in place. So what you can see is a mixed regulatory framework where what we have is private mechanisms such as corporate social responsibility mechanisms, which can largely be defined as written commitments on the part of corporations of all sizes to comply on their own will with either international labour organisation standards, so the core labour standards that we have in ILO conventions, or other international conventions. So a commitment, so a written commitment to comply with a variety of standards in the conduct of business. And they may cover a number of different areas, depending on which corporation we are dealing with, you know, ranging from ethical conduct, fair business practices, observance of the rule of law, environmental standards, or in the more fortunate cases, employment and labour rights. But this seems might seem all good on paper, but unfortunately there is empirical evidence that shows that these corporate social responsibility mechanisms, so CSR mechanisms, have become a legitimacy token for these big companies to say, look how good we are. You know, we have our own codes of conduct. We are respecting labour rights. But then when we look closer on the ground, then we see that, you know, big corporations like Nike might have literally one person monitoring compliance by their own directors, their own managers, of compliance with these voluntary-based mechanisms. And so there is an issue there of monitoring, right? So lack of monitoring. So some observers, NGOs, or human rights activists are less enthusiastic because they say this is just an instrument for corporations to show, to give, you know, a reputable public image. What is known, you might have heard, with greenwashing, right? So in relation to the environment, but more recently there have been other terms being coined like blue washing, you know, to refer to similar aspects in relation to labor rights, for example. And so there's ample evidence suggesting that CSR does not really meet its promises, and it has been criticized for a number of years. What we then have are other instruments which are not yet legally binding. So, okay, so we have to move every once in a while. So what we have is, I will start with the so-called RUGI principles. Some of you might be familiar with these, after the name of the expert who prepared these guiding principles for business and human rights. So as I said, they are normally generally known as the RUGI principles, and they provide an international standard for preventing and addressing the risk of adverse human rights impact of business activity. And they are held in high regard. The UN Human Rights Council unanimously endorsed them, making these guiding principles the first corporate human rights responsibility initiative to be endorsed by the United Nations. And in fact, there's reference to these UN guiding principles in many other international instruments. They're also cited by the EU. They're cited in some of these codes of conduct. But unfortunately, together with the other instruments that we have here, you know, the ILO Tripartite Declaration of Principles concerning Multinational Enterprises and Social Policy, the OECD Multinational Enterprise Guidelines, which have recently been updated as well, they all share the same limitation, that they cannot be invoked in court. They are soft in nature. And that is because they have not been designed as mandatory legal standards. They're just guidelines, as the same name indicates. On maybe a more positive note, you know, we might cite social labelling schemes. You might be aware of these as consumers. You know, when you go and buy something, you might check whether, I don't know, bananas, for example, whether it's the label of fair trade, or rug mark, for example, fair trade in relation to clothes, to make sure that there's no child labour, for example. These have been quite influential because there's evidence that increasingly people, as good citizens, as good consumers, feel compelled to do something, right? We're all fairly well informed of what's happening, and we are more careful when we buy something, or at least we do our best to do that. But as I said, this is clearly not enough. It's not enough when it gets to, as I said, and this is a clear concern for us as lawyers, to allowing victims of abuses to be able to access courts and to have judicial remedies available to them. A Okay, so so this was sort of giving an overview of the fragmented international regulatory framework. We then move at the sort of bottom level of at what is happening on the ground. And there have been studies already since the end of the pandemic showing that COVID-19 has had profound effects on global supply chains, thereby exposing the exploitative business methods of global retail giants and increasing the awareness of workers, appalling working conditions. And what's happened here is that transnational corporations have exerted even more pressure on producers and suppliers to provide lower prices to consumers. A decisive factor in the cutting of labour costs and deterioration of working conditions. So essentially what these big retail giants have done is they have exploited, taken advantage of the economic downturn that COVID-19 created to carry on their abusive practices by forcing them to carry on producing the material they needed, but at even lower costs. And in doing so, what they've used is the so-called force majeure principle, saying that due to sinking demand and their inability to sell products, that was the only way forward. And in some instances, they even cancelled the orders at the very last minute. And so what COVID-19 has showed is that these global buyers have carried on with these practices and also, what is worse from workers' point of view, refuse to assist suppliers with, for example, severance pay or with covering the cost of furloughing workers, right, which is a practice that was done in many countries, even here in Europe, to at least keep people employed during COVID-19. And so that explains, as I say here, the increase in job losses, particularly because many of the workers in the garment sector do not even have formal employment contracts. So there was no way of helping them. And added to that, COVID-19 worsened situations of unemployment, and not just unemployment, but also what is known as underemployment. And so, as I said, what they did is taking advantage of this state of affairs with very little really left to do for workers. They just had to accept this state of affairs. So this is sort of a rather grim description of what the situation was or has been on the ground up to very recently. And now I want to look at, can we do something about it? So eventually I will go to the national context and then to what the EU has been doing concretely. But the first sort of question was, what about the various free trade agreements that the European Union is increasingly signing with countries in Asia? Why can't the EU try to exert some pressure there, particularly now that the so-called new generation of free trade agreements have trade and sustainable development chapters in their, among the provisions of these agreements? And to put it shortly, these special chapters have social conditionality. So, in other words, they try, but again, with not much teeth, They try to say, okay, if you're signing this agreement with us, the quid pro quo is that you have to improve labour standards in your countries. There are problems there. It would be going slightly outside the scope of today's seminar. But to put it shortly, the problem there is that not only do they not have a proper dispute settlement mechanism, like the trade provisions, you know, a proper sort of system to enforce the provision, but as I say here, when we're talking about free trade agreements, we have to take into account other factors, and this is where political economy studies are really helpful. So there have been some studies which have shown that to really understand the effectiveness of these trade agreements, we need to take into account different factors, or to use their terminology, different variables. And so one of them will be, who is the trading partner of the EU, first of all? If the EU can exert a lot of political and economic leverage, then they will literally try to do something concrete. But if it's, say, even, you know, a country like Singapore, for example, which is very powerful, so the roles change, then Singapore can itself exert quite a lot of pressure on the European Union. Why? Because the EU is keen to have access to the market of Singapore, or likewise with South Korea. You know, that's another example. Because, for example, the manufacturing sector has been losing out. There are various variables. The geopolitical context, which I've just explained now, is definitely very important. The labour regime of the partner country itself, is it a country which has a tradition for protecting labour rights? We know that many Asian countries do not have a tradition for protecting human rights in premise. So just imagine in relation to workers' rights. The other factor that I think is very interesting that these studies have highlighted are power relations. So the differences between lead firms and supplier firms, or particularly going back to the EU market, as I say here, import-dependent firms. Obviously, if you are importing products, you will not want to have clauses, provisions in these agreements which will make it harder for you or more expensive to import products from these countries. And that is why global value chains, and for that matter global supply chains, are not explicitly addressed in these trade and sustainable development chapters. What we might have is maybe a loose commitment to corporate social responsibility. And I've mentioned earlier what the limitations are there in relation to corporate social responsibility. Then, looking at it from a narrow legal point of view, there are also other problems, because my concern here today is not to look at it from sort of top-down perspective. My concern is, what can workers do? What do they have in terms of the law to access courts and to bring a claim, a successful claim, against their employer? Not even the multinational corporation, you know, even just their employer. Very little, if we rely on free trade agreements, because some of you will know that a very strong limitation, and this has been even confirmed by the General Court of the EU, is that free trade agreements do not have direct effect. And what does that mean concretely? It means that citizens of the partner country of these agreements cannot rely directly on the provisions of the free trade agreement. So if we imagine some clauses, as increasingly they are, I mean, if we look at the agreement with Canada, there are some really promising provisions there, but nothing that an individual can rely on directly. Right? So they can't rely on the provisions of the free trade agreement. Only the partner country would, or maybe might, I should say, start a dispute settlement mechanism. But even there, we know they're very long, right? Dispute settlement procedures take a very long time. You know, a panel has to be set up, and both parties have to agree to it, and so on. In the meantime, what do workers get? Very little. And so from a very narrow legal point of view, free trade agreements are not the way forward for workers. Some have started to suggest, oh, maybe we can start relying on the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights. You know, some argue that some of the provisions contain justiciable rights that might have extraterritorial application. But we know that extraterritoriality is something, the minute you mention it, it's a bit like opening a can of worms, right? It's very complicated to apply. And this is even more so in relation to social rights. Why? Because if you look at the Charter, the provisions on social rights are conceived, some of them, as principles rather than individual subjective rights. And what does that mean? It means, as we all know, that as principles, and I'm not talking about general principles of EU law, I'm talking about principles which are have the nature more of guidance, are not justiciable. And so that will then be left again to courts to assess, well, the Court of Justice to decide, are we dealing with a fundamental right? The only exception would be those which coincide with the ILO core labour standards that we know are fundamental rights. But this is just to give you an idea of how complex it is from a legal point of view. Now, moving on then to the national level, the national context. As I said, there are some examples, and this is a map again that I've taken from the European Coalition for Corporate Justice, which I know it's impossible to read what it says, but I'll be happy to give you the link. But I think it gives you an idea of how clearly this is an issue that has gathered momentum. Because all, well, I would say the most important EU countries have already done something about it in their legal system or are about to do something. And for the purpose of the seminar, I will just flesh out the most important ones. So we can group them into three broad categories. So we have one set of laws which are mandatory disclosure and transparency laws, which require companies to disclose information regarding their human rights and environmental impacts, or on specific human rights issues. And here, the most, the best example is the UK Modern Slavery Act 2015, which requires companies to publish a statement about the risks of labour abuse in their supply chains. There are problems there in terms of, you know, this disclosure obligation becoming a ticking box exercise. The other problem there is that it ends there, right? There's only an obligation, but there isn't any sanction if they fail to do that. So that's another sort of major limitation. There's then another group of laws which, in addition to having this obligation of disclosure, also have an additional standard of conduct for companies to ensure the respect for human rights, with enforcement measures for failure to comply with this due diligence obligation. And an example is the very recent, and in fact I should stress they're all very recent legislative measures, the Netherlands Child Labour Due Diligence Law of 2019. And this imposes three main obligations. First of all, a duty to investigate By means of due diligence, whether there's a reasonable suspicion that goods or services to be supplied have been created using child labour, a duty to develop and execute a plan of action, so if this is the case, in compliance, so this is significant, there's explicit reference to the ILO child labour guidance tool for business. And third, a duty to issue a statement to the supervising authority that it observes the these requirements. There's then a third group, and this is the most recent set of laws, which have another step. So not just a disclosure obligation, not just a standard of conduct, but actually they establish also the legal consequences for failing to comply, i.e. there's civil liability envisaged if they fail to comply. And here we have France's duty of vigilance law 2017, Germany's Act on Corporate Due Diligence in Supply Chains of 2021, and the Norwegian Transparency Act 2021. So, as I said, all very recent pieces of legislation. Now, these are all to be welcomed. I'm not suggesting this is bad by all means, but the problem is that the differences in terms of scope, in terms of enforceability, the types of risks, we also have to take into account the fact that as we all know, the EU is made up of countries with very, very different legal systems or with very different typology of problems. And this explains why there is clearly a rationale for having an EU cross-sectoral legislation on mandatory due diligence, which would establish a single standard of care while adopting a sector-sensitive approach. And most importantly, the significance of this directive, which, as I said, will pass, it's only a matter of a few months now, it introduces a substantive obligation rather than a mere procedural standard of conduct for companies. And so this brings me to the directive. This has been proposed by the European Commission after, you know, extensive consultation. It was extremely broad. All stakeholders, relevant stakeholders, so not just governments, were involved in the consultation. And it was proposed in February 2022. So not long ago. And what is important is that it has been conceived as an internal market measure. So if we look at the legal basis of this directive, Article 50 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union on Freedom of Establishment, and Article 114, TFEU on approximation of laws, are the key provisions that have been used to propose this directive. And I think that per se is already telling, you know, the fact that it's being conceived as an internal market measure. But as I said, we are going to start with the positives rather than the negatives. I mentioned before that this is not a one-off instrument. The directive is part of the EU Sustainable Corporate Governance Initiative, which was launched in 2020, and the goal of ensuring decent work worldwide. And so the proposed corporate sustainability due diligence directive is part and is meant to be seen as a complement to existing legislation, such as the Conflict Minerals Regulation, the Timber Regulation, the Human Trafficking Directive, as well as other voluntary initiatives to address human rights violations and environmental abuses in specific sectors. And it also builds on another important instrument in the context of corporate governance, and that is the Non-Financial Reporting Directive. This is already in force, so it's meant to add another layer of protection, because this is just a disclosure. The directive only provides for a disclosure obligation, whereas the proposed directive that I'm analysing now, or shortly to analyse, provides also, envisages civil liability mixed with administrative sanctions if companies fail to comply with the directive. As I say here, it is far-reaching, you know, in terms of extraterritoriality, but, you know, we have to really also define extraterritoriality, which I won't, at least not now, but it's far-reaching. It has a far-reaching potential. I think it's better to say potential, because it would cover not just EU companies, but also non-EU companies that operate in the EU internal market. Yeah. But no, the reason why I'm saying whether it's extraterritorial, because I see Chiara nodding her head, is because it, you know, there are some academics like, you know, Professor Scott, who say it's not extraterritoriality, it's territorial extension of EU law, right? Because it follows the companies where they operate. So that's why I use that word with caution, extraterritoriality. But what matters is, if they operate in the EU, then they have this obligation to comply. And that's where we can see that it addresses what I was saying before, the so-called regulatory chilling effect, right? That because it's all over the EU, they can't then decide to trade somewhere else or to move maybe their subsidiaries somewhere else, because it's going to be the same across the whole of the EU market. I won't go into too much detail, because I know we are almost at the end. But I think the other significant aspect of the directive is the personal, in addition to the personal scope, is the size of these companies. So they have to be very large companies. And this has been criticized, because effectively what happens is that the directive would not cover small and medium enterprises or small companies. And I think that's a valid point. Many have said, why are you excluding small and medium enterprises? Why are you excluding small companies? Does it mean that there's no abuse or violation of workers' rights in small and medium enterprises? In fact, some say a fortiori, you know, that actually, where there's less, you know, smaller companies, there's less monitoring, right? Things are not done in a such transparent manner as in larger companies. So that is a criticism that has been made. And in fact, the European Parliament, unsurprisingly, in one of its resolutions, has said that small and medium enterprises should be included. On the more positive note, what we should consider is the fact that there is an enforcement system envisaged in the directive. So it's made up of, as I said earlier, administrative sanctions up to having civil liability provisions in place, with a European network of supervisory authorities. So that's not really new. We've seen it in other areas of EU law. So that would create a better coordination between national authorities. So I think, again, that's something to be welcomed, right? Because it ensures that there's more information between national authorities across the whole of the EU. Now, here I just touch upon some of the problems that have been envisaged. And we shall see what the final version of the directive is, because you might not be surprised to learn that the Council and the European Parliament don't see eye to eye, right? So the Council has tried to dilute the obligations, whereas the European Parliament has tried to make them more stringent. But I mentioned already the first one, the problem of why only large sizes, and that seemingly does not comply with the RUGI principles that I mentioned earlier, so with the United Nations guiding principles, in particular guiding principles 1 and 2, which do not distinguish between companies. The size doesn't matter. Everyone, any company has an obligation for responsible business conduct. Also, the directive seems to treat differently mid-cap companies, and here, you know, we're talking about technical aspects, which I don't want to go into detail now, but the problem is that certain companies in particular sectors, and for the purpose of the seminar today, the textile sector, the provisions only apply for severe adverse impacts. And we know as lawyers that the problem is there, what does severe adverse impact mean? Again, there's a problem of the terminology used in the directive in relation to established business relationship, i.e. that is excluding a lot of subsidiaries, a lot of suppliers, because again, it raises a problem. What do we mean by established business relationship? So if you don't have an established relationship, then you are exempted, no liability. So that has raised many eyebrows. And again, it doesn't seem to comply with the RUGI principles, which doesn't make such distinction. It just talks about a business relationship. So whenever there is a business relationship, everyone has to comply from top to bottom. And so the concern is that this is, you know, that the risk might be that the outcome is a directive which is only helping corporations in the so-called green transition, right, to help them understand how they can comply with existing EU legislation, as I said, also in relation to the environment, but that's where it would end, and that it fails to focus on ensuring adequate access for workers to have proper remediation. Okay, so as I said, context is quite grim. I've highlighted some of the limitations, the positives, the cons of the directive, and so I wanted to end with some more positive aspects and to go back to some of the things mentioned earlier. So starting with trade agreements. They were on the slide, but I didn't mention them before. But the investment state dispute settlement clauses can be very pernicious for social conditionality, because they can be used by corporations to sue states. And, you know, this has happened concretely. So it's not just something that might happen. And so one of the first suggestions is to integrate a due diligence duty in the more recent, in the new or future investment, trade and investment agreements. And there is an example of this in the Morocco-Nigeria bilateral investment agreement. This is of 2016. This is a first international investment agreement which has an explicit due diligence duty. And when I say due diligence duty, I mean not just a human rights duty, but also a sustainability due diligence duty in its very first article. And so this shows that it is a possibility and not just sort of a wishing well suggestion. So it is, I think, a matter of time, but and obviously of having the right political momentum. COP28 doesn't seem very promising, but I think we have to remain hopeful that it will happen in other international investment agreements. The other suggestions to improve the effectiveness of the directive, and this ties in with the criticisms made to the personal scope, is to extend it to all companies. So rather than just focusing on the larger corporations, also to small and medium enterprises, because we know that some countries, including Italy, has an economy which relies on small and medium enterprises rather than major corporations, besides very few. The other suggestion is to, and it is hoped that, you know, somehow the European Parliament and the Council agree on that in the final draft, on broadening the notion of business relationship. Some more concrete suggestions, which are not mine, but Bueno and Bright, two excellent colleagues, have proposed some improvements in relation to the civil liability regime. So they suggest to impose a statutory corporate due diligence duty. Concretely, this means having a presumption that companies can be liable for the damage caused by their suppliers. And this would go hand in hand with having a broad notion of business relationships. So it would also extend to subcontractors. And this would go would tie in also with the notion of strict liability. So relying on strict liability would then in turn establish a due diligence defence, effectively shifting the burden of proof. So it would make it much easier for claimants to bring a claim, a successful claim, I should stress, because they do bring claims, but 90% of them are so far unsuccessful. And then the last two suggestions are sort of my own breed, so to speak. So one, this is too late, obviously, but I think it's still worth mentioning. I would have advocated for a regulation rather than a directive. We do know the advantages of directives. Why? Because they leave a lot of flexibility to countries as to how they want to comply with the obligations. But then the problem is that, in my view, too much flexibility leads to discretion, and then there's a problem of non-compliance by some countries with regard to the directives. And, you know, we only have to look at the number of enforcement actions by the Commission to know how problematic directives are. And lastly, my recommendation would be to have a so-called due diligence mainstreaming approach, because there's no point having measures only tackling one sector, that is, you know, trade or corporate governance, when we know that the problem is systemic, right? So we need to have a due diligence provision in other legislative measures. And there is one example, and that is the public procurement directive. And this is of 2014, so it's been in place for quite some time. And you know, Corvalia has already examined the usefulness of having social conditionality in public procurement, because we have similar problems there, right, of having different suppliers along the chain. And what is significant about this public procurement directive is that there is explicit reference to the UN Guiding Principle 6. So there's explicit reference to this obligation stated in the UN Guiding Principles, that states should promote respect for human rights by business enterprises with which they conduct commercial transactions. There's also explicit reference to the 1952 Labour Clauses Public Contracts Convention and its accompanying recommendation, which refer to the inclusion, to the need to include social clauses in public contracts. So my point there is that things can be done. You know, there are concrete measures that can be adopted. We don't need to rely, and I would say we shouldn't just rely, even on the proposed directive, once it enters into force, we shouldn't just rely on that piece of legislation, but rather we should inject a due diligence obligation in other areas which are relevant to corporate governance and which are relevant to responsible business conduct. That's all. Thank you very much for listening.